Hey, this is Mike Bobbitt. I'm a guy who used to make things, and sometimes I still do. These days, I prefer making podcasts, and I have a new one called Soundtrack to My Life. On this podcast, I talk to different creative people about the music that shaped them. Sometimes the conversations are funny, and sometimes they're just kind of sweet.
I love that Pina Colada song. Yeah, I do.
Rihanna has had a huge impact on my songwriting.
I'm diving into the ocean, finding that one fish that has the toxins, and I'm just drinking those toxins all day.
Maybe they're saying, like, you should now go forth and rock. It's like a peace be with you situation.
I also have a playlist called F-Jams. One into it, just in case.
We dance to a jazz version of My Favorite Things.
Soundtrack to My Life. It's available exclusive on Spotify. It's a exclusive. I'm going to try to make that word take off. It's a music plus talk show, meaning I can play songs in their entirety. So think of this as an interactive playlist with some of the coolest creative people I know, and you should know too. Soundtrack to My Life, a Spotify exclusive.
Welcome back to Great Lakes Confidential with Angie and Marty.
Hello.
Hey, Marty. How are you?
Good. Yourself?
I'm fantastic. Fantastic. We're in that, we're in that that weird limbo between Christmas and New Year's that's like impossibly long of a week, but also somehow very, very short. And you're just kind of like, don't really know what's happening and where you're going. You know what I mean? So it's like... Yeah. And then with the holidays, I don't know what's going on this morning, but then with the holidays being in the middle of the week, it's got me completely screwed up at work. Like, I went to work on Thursday thinking it was Monday and just, just very lost.
I know that feeling at my day job at the print shop. We worked Monday and we worked Friday.
What?
And it was just... Yeah, like we had, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday off. So just coming in Friday, it was just like, man, like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
What are we even doing here? Like, I don't even know what day it is anymore.
Right. And then I don't do, like, orientation for new hires during this time period because it's very difficult to get people in for orientation during the holiday season. And then you're working these weird short weeks. So I don't really do it. So I haven't had, like, a ton of stuff to do. I mean, you know, I'm still working through like open enrollment and like my regular HR stuff, but it's like there's just not a lot of stuff that's like piling up or anything. And so it's just kind of like I'm just like at work trying to find stuff to work on, which is a good problem to have. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's also it also can make the days go really long when you're not keeping super busy. So I'm just like in this weird holiday purgatory.
Right.
And I'm just really excited for it all to be over with. So bring on the new year. Actually, by the time this airs, it will be 2025. So that's pretty exciting. So
yes.
Yay.
Yes. Bring it on.
Yeah. So before we actually get started on the show, I got a Facebook message on our Great Lakes Confidential Facebook page. So wanted to share that. It's kind of funny because the guy's name is Ken, which was my grandpa's name. And today we're talking about the Hudson Motor Car Company, which was my grandpa's passion. So it just, I don't know. It's one of those things that kind of makes me smile a bit. So anyway, here's what Ken says. I recently discovered your podcast and I'm absolutely loving the content. Your Pine Knob episode brought back on one of my favorite memories. My best friend Mark and I saw Roger Waters during his Radio Chaos tour there. It had poured rain that night, and they allowed the lawn audience to move into the pavilion. During the end of the show, it stopped raining, and we decided to head toward the exit to beat the traffic, making our way to the now-empty lawn. Just as we reached the lawn section, Roger started singing, "The Lunatic is on the Grass." They turned on the floodlights, and there we were, just the two of us, standing on the lawn, waving our arms and singing along. It felt like an unforgettable, serendipitous moment made just for us.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's great.
I love it. I'm so happy that somebody gave us a Pine Knob story, because that's cool. So, yeah, and like just getting messages, it makes all the, like, I put a lot of work into the show, and getting messages from our listeners just makes it all worth it. So thank you, Ken. Yeah. I appreciate that message.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, for sure.
He'll stick around for a while.
I hope so. I wonder if he started with Pine Knob or if he started at the beginning. Who knows?
Who knows?
There are a lot of downloads happening right now of like older episodes. So, yeah, I don't know.
Ken, if you need a recommendation, the Grandy Ballroom episode.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that one. That was a good one, too. All right, so today's show is about the Hudson Motor Car Company, or Hudson Motors, which was founded in 1909. Joseph L. Hudson, owner of the Detroit department store, was the primary investor in the company, created by 8 individuals, including Roy Chapin and Howard Coffin, who were former employees at Old Motor Works. In the first year, Hudson Motors sold 4,000 of their original 4-cylinder models. This represented the highest number of first-year sales of any car company to that point, and quickly earned Hudson respect in the American auto market. At this time, Hudsons were sold for less than $1,000, which would be equivalent to just over $33,000 in today's money. The company quickly started production with the first car driven out of a small factory in Detroit on July 3rd, 1909 at Mack Avenue in, I'm going to screw this name up, Beaufort Street on the east side of Detroit.
It's good enough.
B-E-A-U-F-A-I-T.
Sure, Beaufort.
All right.
Old country Beaufort, I guess.
The new Hudson 20 was one of the first low-priced cars on the American market and became successful with 4,508 sold the first year. This put the newly formed company in 17th place industry-wide, a remarkable achievement at the time, when there were hundreds of makes being marketed. It's crazy for me to think that in the early 1900s, there was so many different cars being made.
Yeah.
Like, it's just hard for my brain to, for that to, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy, and I guess there's probably just as many, well, like, companies and all that. I don't know, it's just weird, like, the amount of companies that have come and gone.
Yeah.
Made classic cars, and now we have, you know, Daewoo.
Right. I wonder if they could ever bring Hudson's back, like, but like, yeah, with their old style, like that old body style. It would be so crazy to see those driving on the roads today, because those are,
oh man,
big cars.
Incredible. Yeah, it's funny, like every few years, like they kind of have a car come along that sort of is a nod to the past and the old body styles, but mm-hmm. they never really quite like first of all, it's usually just that one-off car, and you know, it doesn't like dictate trends moving forward. You don't see a lot more like throwback kind of styled cars, mm-hmm. and they never quite get it right. I don't know if it's just that they don't use like the same amount of metal, like just that heavy, mm-hmm. you know, heavy body metal, that it just, I don't know. Anyway, yeah. Sorry to just derail you.
No,
there.
No.
I was thinking of the PT Cruiser and the old Thunderbird like 20 years ago when they tried to reintroduce that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
No, it's a good point that, like, you know, stuff like the Mustang, they keep bringing that back, and, you know, like the old Mustang, and like even the Bronco, you know, they tried really hard to make it as close to that, you know, old Bronco as they had it. And it's close, you know, but it's definitely it's more of a reminiscent style than it is like the actual style.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious to see if they could bring back the Hudsons, what they would look like, because there's no way they would use all that metal. There's no way.
Right.
That's crazy. So, but those cars are huge anyway. So I don't know, but I'd still be curious to see. So,
yeah.
Successful sales volume required a larger factory. A new facility was built on a 22-acre parcel at Jefferson Avenue and Connor Avenue in Detroit's Fairview section that was diagonally across from the Chalmers Automobile Plant. The land was the former farm of DJ Campau. Right? Is it Campau or Campo?
Campo. Campo. Usually, I mean, yeah. Well, that's, I mean, that's just how it, the name gets pronounced. DJ Campo,
you yeah, say? DJ Campo.
The superstar DJ Campo?
It was designed by the firm of renowned industrial architect Albert Kahn with 223,500 square feet and opened on October 29th, 1910. Production in 1911 increased to 6,486. For 1914, Hudson's for the American market were now left-hand drive. So I believe that means that the first cars had the steering wheels in the middle of the vehicle. Yeah. And the reason why I think that is because I've actually been lucky enough to ride in one of the old 1900 Hudsons, and that's where the steering wheel is, and there's no top to them, so I'm sure people yeah. can kind of picture this in their minds, but very probably reminiscent to like the Model T,
right?
I would think, but yeah, this,
I was thinking like a go kart almost,
yeah,
like just with the middle steering.
Yep, that's exactly yeah, the big metal steering wheel, just right smack dab in the middle of the front seat of the car, No top on them. I don't know how fast they go. They don't go super fast. I think we were able to riding in it probably like 10 to 15 miles an hour. So not very fast. And we didn't take it out on the road. It was just in a parking lot. But we got to ride in one and it was really kind of cool. So I'll see if I can find the pictures of those, of that when we rode in that. That was at the Hudson National a couple of years ago. So anyways, Fisher Body Company built bodies for Hudson cars until they were bought out by General Motors in 1919. From 1923, Hudson bodies were built exclusively by Massachusetts company Biddle and Smart. The lucrative contract with Hudson would see Biddle and Smart buy up many smaller local coach builders to meet the Hudson demand. Peak shipments came in 1926 when the company delivered 41,000 bodies to Hudson. An inability to stamp steel meant that their products were made using aluminum. So it sounds like they changed over what they were using. It was probably cheaper, too, I would imagine.
Yeah.
On July 1st, 1926, Hudson's new $10 million, which is over $100 million in today's money, so their new $10 million body plant was completed where the automaker could now build the all-steel closed bodies for both the Hudson and Essex models. Biddle and Smart continued to build aluminum body versions of the Hudson line and were marketed by Hudson's as custom built, although they were the same as the steel body vehicles. With Hudson now building in-house, Biddle and Smart saw their work for Hudson drop by 60%. From 1927, Hudson gradually began to utilize local coach builders Briggs Manufacturing Company and Murray Corporation of America to supplement Hudson's production, which was expanding domestically and internationally. With car prices falling due to the Great Depression and the cost to transport vehicles from Massachusetts to Detroit becoming too expensive, the contract with Biddle and Smart was terminated in 1930, and Biddle and Smart went out of business shortly thereafter. That's a bummer.
Yeah.
At their peak in 1929, Hudson and Essex produced a combined 300,000 cars in 1 year, including contributions from Hudson's other factories in Belgium and England. A factory had been built in 1925 in Brentford in London. Hudson was the third largest U.S. car maker that year after Ford Motor Company and Chevrolet. That was information I did not know.
That they were the third largest?
Yeah.
I
feel like I should have known that because of my family, but that was new information to me.
Yeah, I mean, my mind is just kind of like going in a different direction. Like, I mean, Hudson, they were gone before I was born.
But yes.
They were around for, I mean, decades. You know what I mean?
Like, about 50
just
years.
Just listen to your story and telling the story. Like, people probably would have assumed that Hudson would have been around forever. Like Ford, like General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they just seem like these giant companies that'll be around forever.
Yeah.
And I imagine, yeah, that's how Hudson seemed.
Yeah. Knowing that they were, you know, top three. It's like, what? Yeah. Hudson had many firsts for the auto industry. These included dual brakes, the use of dashboard oil pressure and generator warning lights, and the first balanced crankshaft and the first balanced crankshaft, which allowed the Hudson straight six engine, dubbed the Super Six, to work at a higher rotational speed while retaining smooth, developing more power for its size than lower speed engines. The Super Six was the first engine built by Hudson. Previously, Hudson had developed engine designs and then had them manufactured by Continental Motors Company. Most Hudsons, until 1957, had straight six engines. The dual brake system used a secondary mechanical emergency brake system, which activated the rear brakes when the pedal traveled beyond the normal reach of the primary system. A mechanical parking brake was also used. Hudson transmissions also used an oil bath and cork clutch mechanism that proved to be as durable as it was smooth. So they were pretty innovative, for sure.
Yeah.
As the role of women increased in car purchase decisions, automakers began to hire female designers. Hudson, wanting a female perspective on automotive design, hired Elizabeth Ann Thatcher in 1939, one of America's first female automotive designers. Her contributions to the 1941 Hudson included exterior trim with side lighting, interior instrument panel, interiors and interior trim fabrics. She designed for Hudson from 1939 until 1941, leaving the company when she got married.
Okay, but she was there.
She was there.
But she was there.
Yep. As ordered by the federal government, Hudson ceased auto production from 1942 until 1945 to manufacture material during World War II, including aircraft parts and naval engines, as well as anti-aircraft guns. The Hudson Invader engine powered many of the landing craft used on the D-Day invasion of Normandy, June 6, 1944. During World War II, Hudson had also an aircraft division that produced ailerons for one large Eastern airplane builder. The plant was capable of large-scale production of wings and ailerons as well as other airplane parts. On May 22, 1941, Hudson was given a contract for the Orlikon 20mm cannon with the Jefferson Avenue plant on Jefferson and Connor Avenues, responsible for converting the original Swiss drawings to American production standards. The company produced 33,201 Orlikons for the U.S. Navy, with the original mechanism continued in use without major change and with complete interchangeability of parts until the end of the war. Hudson also manufactured millions of other weaponry and vehicle parts for the war effort. Hudson ranked 83rd among U.S. corporations in the value of World War II military production contracts. Production resumed after the war and included a 128-inch wheelbase, three-quarter-ton pickup truck.
There we go.
There we go.
Sorry, back to business. Yep. Let's get that pickup truck out, boy. It's been sitting on the desk for 3 years.
As the post-war marketplace shifted from a seller's to a buyer's market, the smaller U.S. automakers, such as Hudson, found it increasingly difficult to compete with the big three, Ford, GM, and Chrysler, during the 1950s. A sales war between Ford and General Motors conducted during 1953 and 1954 had left little business for the much smaller independent automakers trying to compete against the standard models offered by the domestic Big Three. The Big Three could afford constant development and styling changes so that their cars looked fresh every year, whereas the smaller manufacturers could only afford gradual changes. Hudson's once innovative step-down unit body construction, while sturdy and innovative, also made restyling difficult and expensive. Although Hudson's dominated racing during this period, their feats did little to affect showroom traffic, despite incorporating their NASCAR success into a marketing campaign known as Win on Sunday, Sell on Monday. Sales fell each year from 1951 until 1954, and only Korean War military contracts kept the company solvent. On March 20, 1954, the Hudson Motor Car Company reported a loss of $10,411,060 in 1953 as compared with a profit of $8,307,847 in 1952.
Oh, geez.
After the company's high-priced Jet compact car line failed to capture buyers in its second straight year, Hudson CEP A.E. Barrett engaged with George W. Mason, CEO of Nash Kelvinator, makers of Nash and Rambler, to discuss the possibility of a merger with Nash. Mason already had the vision of merging the four independent automakers, which was Nash, Hudson, Packard, and Studebaker, into one company to compete with the Big Three, having floated the idea as early as 1946 with Packard to no avail. Mason had previously discussed the idea with Barrett in 1952. On January 14, 1954, an agreement was reached and Nash and Hudson executives took the first steps to bring the two companies together. On May 1, 1954, Hudson merged with Nash Calvinator to become American Motors Company. George W. Mason became CEO and president of AMC, while Hudson's president, A.E. Barrett, retired to become an AMC board member. The Hudson factory, located in Detroit, was converted to military contract production at the end of the model year, and the remaining 3 years of Hudson production took place at the Nash plant in Kenosha, Wisconsin, building rebadged Nash cars with the Hudson brand name. The last Hudson rolled off the Kenosha assembly line on June 25th, 1957.
Interesting. So I didn't know that Hudson became AMG, AMC.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
What else I find interesting, when was the highway system developed? That was like 1956?
Yeah, like the 50s, 60s. I'm not sure the exact year, but yeah, post-war.
56 stands out to me for some reason. And then Hudson's were done in 57. So they never even really got to drive on the highway like that. I mean, there were obviously people were still, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're the classic road trips, you know, down, you know, Route 66 or US 12. They were definitely a part of those big steel behemoths.
Yeah, they're huge cars.
Just rambling down the road. You've ridden around. Have you actually driven one before?
I can't drive a Hudson because first of all, they're stick shift.
Yeah.
And they're column shifters. So the big old shifter is up with a steering wheel.
And okay. But then you're shifting your gears right there while you drive.
Yes.
That's old timey.
Yeah. My grandma can drive one. And my oldest son got to drive one. He was like 16 or 17, and it was for my uncle's wedding. My son got to learn how to drive the 49 convertible so that he could drive my aunt, my uncle, and my new aunt around the block in the Hudson. So,
very cool.
Yeah, that was really cool. I'll have to see if I can find that picture, too.
I was just curious as to how they drove. You know, the old steel body.
Yeah.
Know, designs like that. Like, just, I just picture this, you know, it's kind of like pushing a couch across the,
yeah.
the living room floor.
They, you know, from my memory, they're smooth, they're a smooth ride. Like, you know, but they are.
I'm sure it's great. It's like the alignment and all that other stuff. I'm thinking, like, I imagine this thing's just got shocks from hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's just basically like this big, heavy floating cloud just kind of bouncing down the street. But I'm picturing like the pre, you know, power steering years.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, just trying to like constantly keep this thing going in a straight line.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why. Like, that's just what I'm thinking of. This thing, I always think of tanks.
Yeah. Well,
you know, after we went to the Hudson Museum years ago and saw some of those older cars, like, they're tanks.
They are. They're massive vehicles. And that's probably another reason why we would never see a resurgence or like a, you know, whatever they call when they bring old things back out. Like, they would probably never see that because they are. They're the biggest cars I've ever been in. No.
Right. It wouldn't be the same car at all. It'd be, you know, starting with like a fiberglass body, plexiglass, you know, plastic body, something like that. Like, it just, I don't know. I just can't imagine like debuting, you know, one of these old style cars today with, you know, 3 tons of steel in this car getting, you know, 9 miles a gallon.
Right.
I mean, I'm glad they exist. I'm glad they were a thing. They're pieces of art.
Yeah.
You know, more than they are like, you know, precision engineering these days. Like, the engineering's passing by, but I mean, they are artwork.
They really are. And I feel so lucky that Hudson's were such a big part of my growing up, because they are such a cool car. And, you know, I just loved being around them when I was a kid. And, you know, obviously now with my grandpa being gone, I appreciate it even more than I ever have in my life, just having, you know, some of those memories. But it's funny that you mention the Hudson Museum, which we all call it the Hudson Museum. It's actually called the Ypsilanti Automotive Heritage Museum. But that was actually the last Hudson dealership in Michigan, and may have been the last Hudson dealership in the country. But it was Miller Motors, and it's in Ypsilanti, and now it's now that is the Ypsilanti Automotive Heritage Museum. So if you ever get an opportunity to check it out, I highly recommend it. What is it? Based on donations, the cover is like, it's like to get in, it's like $5, a $5 donation or something. It's not a lot of money at all.
It's very inexpensive.
Yeah, it's
neat little walk through time. I mean, I love museums like that.
Yeah, and it's so cool. It's even cooler to me because when you walk through, you see my family's names on different plaques and different things that my family has donated to the museum, and things that, you know, growing up being around all of these Hudson people at car shows and swap meets and different things as a child, I recognize so many different names of, you know, like the Millers. I remember the Millers from being a child and seeing all of their pieces of their collections that they've donated is so, so cool. But you can see, like, they have the old Hudson, you know, we talked about Hudson being in NASCAR and winning NASCAR races. They have that vehicle is there at the museum. And you can actually sit in it.
Giant Hudson going through the wall.
Yeah.
just keeps going.
Those things.
Straight line.
Yeah. I mean, those things are beasts of cars. Like, but they won those races. So, you know, you watch the animated movie Cars and they have Doc Hudson in it. And there is a piece of that movie where they show Doc Hudson racing and, you know, everybody, like the other cars are kind of like, yeah, okay, like this isn't going to work. This car can't win a race. And, you know, and Doc Hudson like talks through exactly how you win a race in a Hudson and how you have to, you know, like where you have to drive the car to turn and, you know, all of those things so that you don't, so that you actually make the turn and you don't go off the trail. And it's really cool.
Now your left arm is going to be shaking at the end of the race from the constant pressure on that steering wheel. You just kind of want to keep tugging at it the entire way.
Right? It's crazy to think that my little grandma can drive one of those cars.
Yeah, I mean, what else could you do? Ring bells at a church?
She's just so tiny and petite. And you put her behind the wheel of one of those, because her and grandpa had matching 49 Hudson convertibles. And they would drive them to different meets and stuff. A lot of times those cars got towed behind because they do have problems with overheating, and they don't get the greatest gas mileage. And, you know, these cars are worth a lot of money. Like
you don't want to blow your excitement on your way to the meet.
Exactly. So, you know, but there were times when, like we would drive to Chesnang, to go to the Chesnang Showboat Parade, and we would ride the cars. Like my sister and I got to ride in the cars in the back seat, and my grandma would drive one of them. I remember she had a big pink panther, stuffed pink panther in the back seat of hers. Or maybe that one was in grandpa's, and she had a Scotty dog blanket in hers because she collected Scotty dogs as well as Hudson memorabilia. But I remember riding in the back of these cars and going to Chesnang for the showboat parade and different swap meets and stuff like that in the area. And it just, yeah, my tiny little grandma could drive the car just like the rest of the guys could. So it's pretty cool.
Whipping donuts.
Yeah. Yeah. She's out there drifting.
Yeah. Just burning out the tires. We have a whole intersection shut down for a drifting contest.
Right, in a Hudson. Oh, man.
Yeah, this giant 10-ton iron tank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, those cars are beautiful. I'm excited to look up some of my old photos of the cars and post them on Facebook for our listeners to check out, because I'm very proud of those cars. I'm very proud of my grandpa and the work that he put into them, because, you know, most of the cars that he had, he restored, like some cars that he restored, he would only have the frame, and he would literally have to piece it all together just on the frame alone. And just being around somebody that was able to literally build a car is just mind blowing to me. Because I could never, like, I can put gas in my car and I can drive it and I can put oil in it. I can't change the oil. I can't do anything, but my grandpa could build an entire vehicle from just a frame. So very cool stuff. So that's the story of Hudson's.
Yeah, that's an amazing story, and it's sad that they're no longer around. But again, they left us with some beautiful automotive art to admire for generations.
Yep.
And yeah, you were lucky to grow up in such a Hudson family and get to ride around in those cars and get to know all about them. And all that, and the camaraderie amongst the Hudson aficionados.
Oh, yeah. These people are close. My grandparents had some of their best friends, you know, I think almost all of their friends were in the Hudson Car Club. And so, so we were just surrounded by cars, you know. And then my grandpa also worked at General Motors, and, you know, his brothers were always into Hudsons as well. So, but the show's not over yet, because we're going to interview my grandma, for the rest of the show, where there's going to be a second part, and we're going to interview grandma and so get her side of the Hudson legacy that my grandpa left behind for us. So so I'm really excited to chat with her and hear some more of their stories. So that'll be exciting. So that's all I got for this one, and then next one we'll do it'll just be me and grandma chatting.
All right. Well, you two ladies enjoy your conversation, and I will talk to you guys later.
Thank you. I hope you guys have a great week, and I hope you come back for the second part.
Definitely.
Awesome. All right. Well,
I like learning about cars, and I like your passion for cars.
Thank you. It's funny having this passion for cars and not being able, like most people that have a passion for cars, they like know something about them, and I don't know a lot about. I mean, everything that I know about Hudson's is just from growing up around them, and then obviously from doing my research here. But I have a passion for the Hudson car because my grandpa did, and so I love it. But anyways, I could just babble on about it forever. I really could. So we're gonna stop here before I go off on other tangents. And
all right, you got a whole nother week.
Yeah, plus you want to hear from my grandma. Trust me, she's got some good stories. So so you guys have a great week. If you haven't already, follow us on Facebook at Great Lakes Confidential. You can email us at greatlakesconfidential@gmail.com. We love hearing your stories. So if you have a Hudson story, please write in and share it with us. We'd love to share it with the rest of our listeners. And if you have show suggestions, we're always taking show suggestions as well. So happy new year. Hope everybody had a great holiday season. Be safe out there. Watch for deer, and text us when you get home.
Bye.
Bye.